Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to open the House Energy and Environment Committee for Thursday, February 5th. So, committee, today we are going to be having a work session for the introduction of a committee measure, which will be LC 2055. So, Jeff, would you like to do that? Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and open the work session.
Chair Vega Peterson, I move that LC 2055, dated 10-6-14, be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay, great. And do you want to go ahead and... So Representative Reardon moves that LC 2055, dated 10-16-14, be introduced as a committee... Is there discussion? Do you want to go through the bill, Beth?
Sure. Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this LC would allow the PUC to authorize electric companies to include in their rate costs funding and implementing cost-effective energy conservation for certain retail electricity consumers above that currently allowed in statute. You should have a copy of it in front of you.
Okay. And just as a reminder for everyone and for those of you who are new on the committee, having a committee bill entered doesn't mean that you are for or against the bill when we have it for consideration as a public hearing. It's just to move it forward in the process. Okay. Right. Is there any discussion? Okay. Any further discussion? Is there objection? If not, the measure is introduced as a committee bill. And I would like to close the work session. All right. The next up, we are going to have I'll open up an informational hearing. We are going to be focusing on what the agencies do that we're going to be working with a lot in this committee. So for that, I'd like to invite up Mike Kaplan, who's the Executive Director of the Oregon Department of Energy. Do we have everybody come up?
Yeah.
Dick Peterson, the Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. Okay, and then we'll go ahead and have Sue and Jason come up next with the next panel. Okay, thank you. Welcome. And please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, Michael Kaplan, Oregon Department of Energy.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. Dick Peterson, Director of Department of Environmental Quality.
Okay, good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. Thank you very much for the invitation to speak today. Today I'd like to talk about who we are as a department, what we do, and where we're going. Oregonians spend about $6.5 billion annually, not including transportation, on energy. About 40% of the electricity consumed in Oregon is produced in-state, and most of that is from renewable sources, mainly hydropower. With these conditions in mind, the Oregon Department of Energy is committed to securing a safe, reliable energy future for the state. As we approach the agency's 40th anniversary later this year, it's interesting to look back on the statutory language that established the department. Not only did it stress sustainability decades before it became a buzzword, but it goes on to say that continued growth in demand for non-renewable energy forms poses a serious and immediate as well as future problem. It is essential that future generations not be left a legacy of vanished or depleted resources, resulting in massive environmental, social, and financial impact. With that responsibility in mind, our agency was established to provide leadership on energy conservation, renewable energy, the protection of the Columbia River from radioactive waste at Hanford, to engage in energy planning and siting of energy facilities, to research and provide expertise on emerging energy technology, to provide educational and technical assistance to industry professionals and the public. Additionally, we collect and analyze energy statistics, data, and information, and conduct objective planning, policy, and technical analysis from a statewide perspective. We are also charged with ensuring state preparedness to respond to emergencies, including those at energy facilities, during the transportation of radioactive materials across our state, and in the event of petroleum shortages. We work to educate the public about ways to conserve energy and develop infrastructure for clean energy resources. Our programs directly touch individual, businesses, communities, and other governments. Those responsibilities fall to five agencies within our division. They're the Energy Development Services, Planning, Policy, and Technical Analysis, Energy Facility Siting, Nuclear Safety, Central Services, and our Director's Office. Though I plan to focus this discussion almost entirely on what we do, I do want to briefly mention our budget. Over the last several biennia, ODO, which receives no general fund, has gotten smaller. For this budget cycle, we've asked the legislature to consider a cut we've proposed of more than 15% to our budget and a staff reduction of more than 6%. Our operating budget is around $54 million, while our loan portfolio and other non-limited resources account for the remaining $140 million. Our revenue is derived from fees for service, revenue from our loan portfolio, the energy supplier assessment, and other miscellaneous forms of resource. We're scheduled to appear in front of you again next week to go into a more detailed review of our Energy Development Services Division, so I'll be relatively brief about that today. We provide loans and incentives via grants or tax credits to consumers, businesses, and governments. Currently, and continuing on work we've already started, and with the direction from the legislature, we are working to strengthen oversight the administration of those programs. Proposed projects come through our doors, receive both a technical and business analysis. We have recently instituted performance agreements. We have historically and continue to conduct compliance visits, and we are looking for ways to constantly improve our stewardship of public resources. In a little finer detail, I'd like to briefly review our Small-Scale Energy Loan Program, or SELP. The program is one of the nation's oldest green banks. Since its inception, SELP has provided loans for conservation, renewable, and other energy projects throughout the state. Through 2014, we've distributed 872 loans, totaling more than $600 million. Loans for this program are funded primarily through general obligation bonds. Collateral is required. Over the course of the last several years and learning from the past, we have strengthened our underwriting throughout the program and ensure a first lien position on any loans that we distribute. An advisory committee, SELPAC, reviews any loan over $100,000. Within SELP, we have several sub-programs, including the energy efficiency financing mechanisms, including the Clean Energy Deployment Fund, Cool Schools, and the Alternative Fuel Revolving Loan Fund. Here's the structure for the incentive side of the shop, our Energy Incentive Program. Energy Incentive Program provides tax credits, grants, and rebates to Oregon homeowners and businesses for energy conservation, renewable energy, and transportation and biomass projects. The oldest of the incentive programs is the Residential Energy Tax Credit Program, created by the legislature in 1977, and the newest is the Alternative Fuel Vehicle Fleet Tax Credit, created by the legislature in 2013. On the renewable side, we have the Renewable Energy Development Grant. These are competitively awarded projects up to $250,000. We recently opened an opportunity for $1.5 million of available funding, which closed on January 23, 2015. We're currently evaluating those proposals right now. We'll cover this more on Tuesday, but the eight sections of the incentive programs are shown in this chart. As I mentioned earlier, they help individuals, businesses, and government agencies. As I mentioned before, the Residential Energy Tax Credit program promotes energy conservation and renewable energy resource development. Since its inception, the program has saved or displaced energy in Oregon enough to power 400,000 homes for 1 year. This is the equivalent of the energy needed to power all the households in the cities of Portland, Lake Oswego, Salem, Springfield, Ashland, Lincoln City, Bend, and Baker City combined for 1 year. Additionally, since 1978, the Oregon Department of Energy has administered the State Home Oil Weatherization Program to serve low-income Oregon households that heat with oil, propane, kerosene, butane, or wood. About 100,000 homes in Oregon are heated with oil or propane. Most of them were built before energy standards were built into building codes and are often in need of weatherization or other heating measures. We also have programs focused on schools. I'll note that as we move forward, you'll start to see the blending of our divisions throughout the rest of the presentation. Energy Development Services works closely with our Planning, Policy, and Technical Analysis Division to deliver programs and resources to schools. Not only do we offer incentives, but we strive to be a resource for technical purposes as well. The department is currently working to better tie our incentives to our policy and technical expertise. Our school programs and several additional that will follow demonstrate that. Through these diverse resources, we promote energy efficiency to help schools save money and ensure healthier, more comfortable learning environments for kids. The Biomass Producer Collector Tax Credit, created in 2007, offers tax credits for the production, collection, and transportation used for energy production. The credit is intended to offset production, collection, and transportation costs. To be eligible for this credit, an applicant must be an agricultural producer or biomass collector, and the biomass material must be sourced from within Oregon. In addition, the biomass must be used as a biofuel or to produce biofuel in Oregon. An earlier slide referenced our Alternative Fuel Vehicles Revolving Fund through our loan program. We also have an Alternative Fuel Vehicle Tax Credit through our Energy Incentive Program. This slide displays some of the projects that we've supported across the state. We'll talk about this in more depth as well on Tuesday. As we move out of energy development services and into planning, policy, and technical analysis, the focus shifts from direct financial resource to policy expertise and leadership on a large variety of energy issues that the state is facing, that you'll note on the side of the slide. To draw your attention to one in particular, this team is leading ODO's efforts to help implement the Governor's 10-Year Energy Action Plan, a major driver of our work across all five divisions. The plan was finalized in 2012. At a high level, the plan asks us to maximize energy efficiency in residential, commercial, industrial, and public building sectors to reduce energy bills. It asks us to develop Oregon's or further develop Oregon's own energy resources. And it asks us to accelerate the use of alternative transportation fuels, including natural gas, electricity, propane, and biofuels. The policy team is also supporting the agency's efforts to help state agencies improve energy efficiency. Our SEED program continues to be a resource to agencies that are constructing new buildings, renovating existing buildings, or simply looking to lower their energy use. We're seeing progress in that program, both from an energy and cost-saving perspective. We recently assisted the state in achieving a goal of an overall 20% reduction in energy costs, and we hit that goal 2 years in advance. Additionally, we will spend this year ramping up the State Building Innovation Lab, part of the 10-year energy action plan, to continue to help state agencies not just reduce their aggregate energy use, but their building by building use as well.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
You mentioned a policy team to provide advice and so forth. Can we know who those individuals are and who they may represent?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, it's our Planning, Policy, and Technical Analysis Division.
This is an internal policy team then?
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Doesn't utilize any external input from outside of the agency?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, we're constantly working with stakeholders, and it's certainly not an isolated or siloed unit. We're constantly working with outside resources. So,
would it be possible for you to make available just who those other outside resources or outside input would be that are contributing to the policy that you're bringing forth?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, I think the list, we would be happy to do it. I think the list we provide would be just about every stakeholder in Oregon, but we can certainly work on that.
Thank you.
No problem.
Just for clarity, but the group that you're talking about itself is all made up of employees within the Department of Energy.
Chair Vega Peterson, absolutely, yes. They're state employees, yes. Next, we'll move to the Oregon Energy Facility Siting Council. The Oregon Department of Energy serves as staff to the governor-appointed and Senate-confirmed Energy Facility Siting Council. Briefly, EFSEC makes siting decisions for large energy facilities throughout the state. ODO provides staff support and resources to that process. We review applications for site certificates, coordinate the review of other state agencies and governments, and issue a proposed decision for public comment and Energy Facility Siting Council consideration. Our facility siting team is involved in some of the higher profile projects throughout the state. In addition to the South Dunes power plant mentioned on the slide before, this team is coordinating the collection of state agency comments on the Jordan Cove draft environmental impact statement that the entire state is working on right now. We're also working on a project that would site new transmission lines between Boardman, Oregon, and Idaho. This work demands that our staff is in the field constantly to discuss projects of significance with Oregonians throughout the state. In January alone, we were in eastern Oregon at least half a dozen meetings related to Boardman to Hemingway public comment. We are also responsible for advocating for Oregon and monitoring the cleanup at the Hanford site in Washington. That responsibility falls to our Nuclear Safety Division. Hanford is the largest cleanup site in the world. Hanford produced plutonium from 1944 through its closure in 1989. Cleanup has been underway since 1989 and is expected to last until at least 2054, but likely well past then. The federal government provides up to $2 billion a year for that work. Among other challenges, we have 56 million gallons of highly radioactive waste stored in 177 underground storage tanks. Massive treatment facilities that are meant to immobilize this waste are being built, but significant design issues remain unresolved. These facilities are not expected to be operating until 2031 at the earliest. After they are operational, it will take another 25 years to contain all of the waste safely. Meanwhile, the ability of those underground storage tanks to hold that waste for the next 40 years is an area of significant concern. The division also oversees our emergency preparedness work. The Oregon Department of Energy is responsible for preparing and responding to nuclear emergencies, handling petroleum disruptions or shortages, improving the resiliency of critical energy infrastructure, and preparing for emergencies related to the operation of liquefied natural gas import facilities. About 29,000 Oregonians live in the communities of Boardman, Irrigan, Hermiston, and Umatilla, which are located within the 50-mile nuclear emergency planning zone for both Hanford and the Columbia Generating Station nuclear power plant in Washington. A fire or other accident involving Hanford's contaminated facilities or the Columbia Generating Station could cause an airborne release of radioactive material. Oregon's primary concern with a radioactive material release for Hanford or the Columbia Generating Station reaching Oregon is protecting people and Oregon's natural resources. ODA works with Morrow and Umatilla counties and several other state agencies to regularly test the Nuclear Emergency Preparedness Program. These tests are evaluated and scored by federal regulators. ODA also maintains a statewide contingency plan in response to severe or long-term petroleum shortages or disruptions that impact the state. The purpose of the plan is to provide an effective response, well-coordinated with industry, governments, and local organizations. The Oregon Department of Energy will implement the plan as appropriate if it anticipates a potential or actual fuel emergency situation in the state. ODO is and has been working to improve the resiliency of our critical energy infrastructure. This will ensure Oregon is prepared to respond to and recover from a catastrophic event. This work, which is done in coordination with the Oregon Public Utility Commission, helps ensure a rapid recovery of energy system in case of a significant emergency. Finally, as part of its emergency preparedness obligations, the Oregon Department of Energy is responsible for protecting the health and safety of Oregonians in the event of a liquefied natural gas emergency. The Oregon Department of Energy works with LNG developers, the U.S. Coast Guard, and local emergency response organizations to develop a comprehensive emergency response plan to be completed prior to construction. All of this work is supported by our Central Services Division and administrative functions, which, among other services, includes IT, budget, procurement, HR, communication, and accounting. They do the heavy lifting to ensure our program staff have the resources and support they need. We have to deliver all of these programs while rebuilding and strengthening the reputation of a department that has a turbulent recent past. Our focus the last few months has been improving our process, learning from our past mistakes, and incorporating lessons learned into our current programs. We are aggressively recruiting as much talent as we possibly can into the agency. We're looking for staff eager to assume the challenge of restoring the Department of Energy. Our turnover rate over the last 5 years has exceeded 100%. We are currently rewriting our mission statement with all of our staff to build ownership of who we are and where we're going. In other words, we have a culture to nurture and build. On the programmatic side, we have a deficit in our SELP program from several loans that defaulted in the mid to late 2000s that will serve as a drain on the general fund if we don't cure it with additional lending within the next 4 to 5 years. Despite the program ending last year, there will be continued scrutiny of projects that received business energy tax credits for the near future. Additionally, there are other programmatic responsibilities that we're working to try and understand and implement. This will not happen overnight, but we're working as hard as we can to right the ship and build your confidence in us. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
I don't see any questions right now, so Dick, why don't you go ahead?
Sure. Do you mind driving?
Yeah. What's up?
Just
I've got to find a better way to do this.
All right. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, director of the Department of Environmental Quality. Really appreciate the invitation to be here. And like Mike, Director Kaplan, I'm going to give a high-level overview of DEQ and really looking forward to working with this committee for sure on issues that might come to you. And our access, your access to us is open, so whatever you might need from us is certainly there. So starting out with DEQ's mission, it's to be a leader in restoring, maintaining, and enhancing the quality of Oregon's air, land, and water. I want to talk a little bit more about that. First of all, that mission supports not only a healthy environment, but a healthy economy. I absolutely believe that you have to have a healthy environment and to have a healthy economy and vice versa. So as we look at what we do in DEQ and how we approach our programs, we keep that in mind. And I hope to highlight that as we go through. The other thing that's really important to highlight, I think, for the work that we do related to our mission is that we do not work alone. I mean, this is DEQ, that's our mission, but it kind of is all of Oregonians' mission. And so it really is important that we keep that in mind, that a healthy environment, clean air, clean water, and productive land is important to everyone in Oregon, not from the elderly to small children. And so it's very important that we keep that in mind as we implement our programs and work with people in across the state. So DEQ has a long history, and this slide kind of shows that history, and I'm not going to go through every point of it. You have it in front of you in terms of some of the major things that have happened within DEQ, but I'll start out with saying the history of environmental regulations date back to 1938. That's when the Oregon State Sanitary Authority was formed, and it was a division of the Board of Health at that time. But this slide does represent how things have changed over the years and some of the things that have happened within Oregon with the input of not only the policymakers like yourselves, but Oregonians to take on environmental issues that are important to Oregon and Oregonians. And so certainly the agency has grown over the decades to address this expanding array of environmental concerns. To implement new federal and state requirements, and we try to mold our programs to those needs. And that's through today, but we continue to evolve as the needs arise, as new policy comes to us or new environmental challenges come to us, we will evolve to meet those with direction from you and the needs of Oregonians. This slide is just a really high-level view of our organization. Right at the top, and I want to point this out, is that we do have a policy and rulemaking body. It's the Environmental Quality Commission. It's a five-member citizen body that's appointed by the governor and approved by confirmed by the Senate. I report to the Environmental Quality Commission, and they oversee and look at our policy and rulemaking that might be come out of the Department of Environmental Quality. The thing I want to point out here at this slide in particular is our organization is fairly flat. And I think that's really, really important. And the reason I say that, if you look at how our organization is laid out, we have three division administrators, and I'll talk in a slide in a minute. And those division administrators are in the regions. They're regional administrators that work in and around Oregonians, and they report directly to the deputy director and to me. So we have decision making in the field, and we see that vitally important to be successful for Oregonians. We have around 723 FTE in the governor's recommended budget, and those folks, I will tell you, work very hard for Oregon and Oregon's environment. And as I said before, it's not us alone, but it's really the partnerships that make a difference to implement the programs that we have. I talked about we have regional offices. We are decentralized. Our implementation work is in the field. These are the offices that we have around the state. where the bulk of our implementation work, our implementation people, live and reside. They live and reside in areas that they work with to either regulate or partner, so they not only understand the environment that's there, the different kinds of geographies that we have around the state, but also the people that are there. They work very closely with the people, businesses, communities, and individuals, and they live and work in that area, so that becomes very important. And I absolutely believe that's very, very important if we're going to be successful in implementing environmental programs, not only to meet environmental demands, but make sure we're addressing and partnering with the economic demands of the state. So this slide is just a very high-level view of generally what we do at Oregon DEQ. And it is modified depending on where you're particularly working, but this is generally what we do. So if you start in the middle where it says standards, first of all, the bulk of the programs that we implement are delegated to us from the federal agency. The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act is a federal environmental regulation, but Oregon has delegated the responsibility of implementing those. And so we have to carry out that responsibility, and that's the bulk of what we do. We certainly have state laws that are not connected to the federal requirements that we implement as well. So with that, we develop standards. There are federal standards, but sometimes we have to develop them for the state. And when we write standards, those are the standards that are written to address air and water and land, primarily to say this is the level that's needed to protect human health and the environment. And so those standards generally, if they're clean air, clean water, are approved by, they pass through Environmental Quality Commission, then are approved by the Environmental Protection Agency. Once we have standards on the book, if you go north from standards, we do monitoring. We do a lot of monitoring around the state. What is the condition of our air, land, and water to know how we're doing compared to the standard? If we are not meeting the standards, then we work to develop strategies. How are we going to get there? And then if you go further follow the wheel, one of the authorities we have is permitting. We write and permits and authorize activities relative to discharge or emission into Oregon's air, water, or on Oregon's land. A big component of what we do is to help and assist businesses and communities comply. I have yet to find someone that does not want to comply with environmental law, and that does not want clean air, clean water, and clean land. So that creates a great partnership to work on how do we get there. Our first launch is if people are having challenges, let's work with them to figure out how they can comply. We do also do compliance and enforcement.
Director, so, one second.
Sorry.
I think we have
excuse
a question.
Excuse me to take a question now.
Oh, sure.
Okay. Just real quick, if just imagine I was had an issue in my neighborhood and wanted to bring that to your attention, mm-hmm. How would I do that? Which one of these boxes is it?
Chair Vega Peterson, Vice Chair Reardon, we have people that are located in the field. So I think the first course would be to contact the regional administrator for that region. Okay. Anyone can call me at any time, so you're certainly welcome to call me.
And, you might be busy.
That's totally fine, but to understand the issue at hand, it's best to go to the regional administrator. And we can certainly get everyone's, get you the names that might be necessary to do that. And we're happy to do that. So back to compliance enforcement, we do do enforcement actions when people do not comply with the law, and sometimes it gets very serious. Or it can range from just a warning letter to warn people that they need to fix the problem to a civil penalty to actually criminal charges, but that is very, very rare, the criminal charge element of it. So that just is a really big, overall picture of how we operate. What I want to do now is just focus on the three areas, air, water, and land, a little bit. I'm not going to talk about each one of those, but I'm going to give you some highlights of some of the things we do in those particular program areas. First, with air, we actually write and manage permits for 2,600 industrial sources through two permitting systems. One are major permits and one are the minor permits. So we do issue a lot of permits for emissions into air. We also do work with communities to develop what we call clean air plans. When air sheds are not meeting standards, we work with communities. What can you do to come back to meet those standards? Because it's not a good thing if they're not in compliance with air standards. We do that through public education, things like wood stove curtailment or wood stove changeout if it's a particulate problem in an area to reduce fine particulate. We test 550,000 vehicles a year in Portland Metro and Medford area, and that's to protect and reduce ozone and toxic air pollutant in those areas. We also know that diesel exhaust is one of the most concerning issues related to air toxics. So since 2008, we have, through grants, have helped reduce diesel emissions across the state by change out, highlighting that we've worked in changing out 452 school buses to non-diesel or a cleaner diesel opportunity. Come on. Flipping to land quality, highlighting some of the programs there. Materials management, that generally refers to solid waste. So we oversee about 348 permits related to solid waste, whether it's a landfill or a transfer station or a compost facility, kind of running the gambit there. We oversee a product stewardship program like e-cycles, where people can recycle their e-waste. And since 2009, we have recycled over 120 million pounds of e-waste in Oregon. And we also help businesses reduce their waste through through their use of toxic chemicals, and try to help them not only reduce their chemical use, but figure out the best ways to reuse and recycle waste that might be generated. One important program I want to highlight is ballast water. It's a very small program, but we do inspect ships that come up come up into the Columbia and other ports to make sure that they exchange their ballast water so they don't bring in invasive species in from Sacramento Bay or other places, which could end up to be a terrible disaster in our waterways. So we do inspect ships to ensure that that doesn't occur. We have an emergency response system where we respond to spills of oil and hazardous waste. We get about 1,500 calls a year, spill calls a year that we respond to. It could just be a phone response, or it could be a full-out. We get out on the ground and work there for a week or so getting a spill managed and cleaned up. We do have a cleanup program where we work with owners and operators to clean up contaminated property from hazardous waste contamination to gasoline and tank contamination. We've worked to clean up 1,200 contaminated sites since 1991, 6,500 leaking underground storage tanks since 1988, and 27,000 leaking home heating oil tanks since 2000. So it's a pretty active program to manage and control contamination from those areas. Water quality. Talking about water quality, I talked about monitoring and assessing water quality. We have a nice network, a good network of measuring surface water quality around the state to help guide us in the best way to work to improve water quality. We have strong partnerships with improving water quality across the landscape, if you will. We work with urban partners, with ag partners, and forest partners to manage areas to improve water quality and work hard to do that. We also issue permits in water arena, 6,300 permits for wastewater discharges to water or land in Oregon, and more than 1,900 stormwater permits. And we also work with counties to oversee the installation and repair of about 800 on-site septic systems per year. The other thing we do is we provide loans. We provide loans to help communities that want to improve their system by upgrading their treatment system or make improvements around that in those areas. And I think later today we're going to talk a little bit more about that with House Bill 2450-51. We have a laboratory in Hillsboro, and that collects samples and takes samples and analyzes them for air, land, and water statewide. Staff collect about 10,000 air and water samples from more than 1,500 locations annually, and resulting in about 300,000 analyses per year. This lab is a state-of-the-art facility. We share it with public health. It's sort of a mirror side. We don't work in exactly the same areas, but it's the same building. I would, if you're any of you are interested in touring that facility, I would welcome you. It's quite a facility to get a good idea of what the state has invested in there. It's quite a facility. So if you're interested, just let me know. Next. Very quickly on the governor's budget, I'm not going to go into this. There'll be lots of opportunity for this later. Our operating budget is about $213 million for the two-year period. This doesn't include non-limited of $112 million. Mostly that's money to hand out or transfer to communities that want to improve their wastewater treatment system through a loan program. In our budget, we have about 15% of our operations is general fund, 2% lottery funds, 13% is federal funds, and the remaining 70% is other fund, primarily fees and cost recovery program for environmental cleanup. I talked about this earlier. Really, collaboration and partnership is key to our success in reaching our mission. So we do take this seriously, as I said before. And we have lots of examples that we can give to you, or I can give to you about that. The one I'm going to highlight real quickly is Pesticide Stewardship Partnership Program, which is really what we work with growers that use current use pesticides. And if things are getting out of hand, maybe into waterways, we work with them how best to improve that. It's a voluntary program. It's not regulatory, and it's been wildly successful. Growers work with us closely. It's rich in data and monitoring, and they really like the results, and we all like the results as well. So that's a great program of partnership where we work with growers. The other thing I wanted to mention is we are wholly invested in regional solutions teams, the regional solutions centers. You may have heard about that. That's a group of five, six agencies located with universities around the state that work together hand in hand. They work in the same office. DEQ has one of those, and working through the governor's office and with the governor's office and local advisory committees help to implement projects that are defined by the advisory committees and need government working together, good government, so entities don't have to go seek out different agencies to find solutions, but can work together. And we take that very seriously. Our folks in the field, regional solutions in the field, report directly to our regional administrator, so they have line of sight and line of contact with decision makers. And so, Representative Reardon, to your point, I mean, our regional solutions folks on the ground, when they hear about an issue, they daylight it and make sure we're ahead of the issue in terms of explaining and working with folks to solve some of those problems. One thing I wanted to mention to you is we, about 4 years ago, we started a new business model for DEQ. And that business model is outcome-based management. And we've been implementing that for a while. I find it really, really important. And all that means is that we focus on the outcomes that we're trying to achieve and don't spend our time on our bureaucracy, our steps. Often I think I'll point to DEQ, we get lost in our process and our steps and lose sight of what we're trying to do. Let's see if we're moving forward to achieve the outcomes and fix the steps if we're not getting there. We do that by, number one, working with our own staff to understand it, but also it's rich in measurements. We not only have key performance measures, but we have another over 100 measurements about outcomes and processes that we trend. We track and we trend. And if we're not doing well, we work on problem solving, we work on fixing that process, and so we can get to the outcome in a much quicker fashion. And I like that because it sort of gives you a foundation for where you need to work and be better, and also you can be accountable and transparent for the work that you do.
Thank you. Representative.
Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the DEQ have any kind of timeline period in which it has to respond to a proposal that's been made by a business or individual or a permit that they're submitting?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Hurd, it depends on which program. We have set targets in our own outcome-based management by which we respond. That's one of our measures, is timeliness of response. It depends on which program you're working in, whether it's a
wastewater treatment.
Oh, wastewater treatment. Mm-hmm. Representative Hurd, really what we do with wastewater treatment, we're constantly working with them. We're looking at when either a new permit might come in or it needs to be re-upped.
Or an adjustment possibly to a conditional use permit.
Yes.
And so,
sorry.
Yeah.
New. Okay. That was it.
Okay. Thank you. Last slide. In conclusion, I think we've done great in Oregon with our environment and over the years with everything that we've done, and we've made huge water quality improvements. Certainly one example, and there's many, is this slide. I mean, people are now swimming and recreating in the Willamette River. You wouldn't dream of that not that long ago. And so that's an example of where improvements have been made in water. Recycling programs have expanded to the point where Oregonians are recovering more than 50% of the solid waste that is generated. That's a great, a nice thing for Oregonians to be proud of. Air quality improvements throughout the state we've improved our air quality throughout the state over the years. In the 1980s, 70% of Oregonians lived in areas where the air did not meet air quality standards. Today, even with more stringent standards, We have far fewer areas that are not meeting air quality standards, although we do have some, and it's a very serious matter. But we have gotten better in terms of our air quality over the years. We still have challenges ahead of us. There's no question. You know, a lot of people are moving into Oregon or expected to move into Oregon. Water's going to be delivered at a different time. Federal standards keep getting more challenging and restrictive. But I am confident that DEQ, working with Oregonians in a transparent and accountable way, we can get ahead of these challenges and be partners to address them and really what I think Oregon's air, water, and land is all about. So with that, happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Director. Representative Reardon.
I didn't want to interrupt you earlier. You mentioned your DEQ lab. Mm-hmm. I worked on a pollinator health task force over the summer, and one of the things that came up is they had didn't really seem to have the capability to do kind of like a forensics investigation if there was a kill off of bees. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't know what the pesticide or what the cause was. Is that something your lab might be able to help with? Or?
Chair Vega Peterson, Vice Chair Reardon, we do have analytical capability to respond to those sorts of things. What we try to make sure is that rather than just running out and collecting samples, we make sure that we can do it in a way that will get, you know, the purpose for why we're out there is right, and how the follow-up could be. But yeah, we have ability to analyze virtually anything in that lab.
Okay, that's good. I may have misunderstood what I was told, but yeah, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Reardon, we'd love to have you visit and see the lab, or any of you. It's a great facility.
Representative Holley.
No, thank you. And I did recently visit the lab. It is a tremendous facility. I recommend people visit it. It's really state-of-the-art. So just speaking of some of the requirements, I know that, for a couple of years ago, we were discussing issues around septic tanks and the impacts on the coastal management zone. And I know we were having issues with our coastal management zone and the water quality of our rivers along the coast. And, as we're, your mission is, aimed at, trying to protect that water quality, maintain it, or enhance it. Just recently, I think in December, the EPA found that Oregon's non-point source pollution problem for the coastal management zone was inadequate, to use a word. And so I'm wondering, having followed this subject for 5 years, I think, are there roadblocks that are keeping DEQ from achieving these goals so that we're not subject to these findings by the EPA and NOAA that we're not doing a good enough job protecting our coastal management zone from pollution. Mm-hmm. Because that is, and a second part of that question, if I may, Madam Chair, is, you know, what are the implications to federal funds that could be impacted that come to Oregon from us not being compliant with those standards?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Hulvey, thank you for the question. Just to let everybody know, just in is a couple weeks ago where the state of Oregon got notice that EPA and NOAA disapproved our coastal zone management program, and they highlighted the reasons for that disapproval. And originally it was conditionally approved for on-site septic system new development, on-site septic system on the on program on the coast, new development on the Coast and Forest Practices Act. What they did tell the state in the response is that they were okay with the on-site septic system program and the new development, but there's work that needs to be done with the Forest Practices Act or Forest Practices on the coast. So that's how they characterized that. I do think they're receptive to how we might work on those issues. So we'll see how that shakes out. But I know certainly our Oregon Department of Forestry is very tuned into this and really focused on what needs to be done to get to program approval. The penalty for that is Oregon DEQ and Oregon Department of Land Conservation gets funding from the federal government to implement the coastal zone program. We get about $2 million a year. It's called $319. We fund some staff with that, but most of that dollar goes to grants to watersheds and others to work on stream improvement. With a program disapproval and down the road, DQ could lose part or all of that money, that grant money with a disapproved program, and Department of Land Conservation would lose, I think, about a third of that money that's coming to the state. So we're still trying to sort that out and figure out what that might mean.
Any follow-up?
Well, I was just curious, what are the outlooks, if I may, what are the outlooks for fixing that so we don't lose that money? Is there, I mean, is the federal government receptive to some sort of action that we can take in the legislature that would show that we're, you know, trying to address this or implementing new programs to address the non-point pollution sources? And that may, you know, be enough for them to restore some of those federal dollars coming to us, because, you know, those are hits, as you know, to your agency and impairs our ability to, or your ability to do your mission.
Yeah. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Hulvey, we just got the disapproval, and we just got the sort of documentation behind that disapproval. So we're looking, the state, are looking in that into detail, and I believe the federal government will be open or receptive to what Oregon might do with that. But I don't have all of the detail with that, but I do know, like I said, the Oregon Department of Forestry is really looking at what might occur to convince the federal government through whatever we might do that they can approve this program. I certainly am hopeful that they will approve the program so we don't lose that funding.
And one more, Madam Chair, and I guess my reason for asking these questions is really, you know, time is short for the legislature, and if it takes some statutory changes to programs or legislative action, you know, we sort of need to know that sooner rather than later, if it will have an impact on trying to come into compliance for that program and restore those funds.
Yeah. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Hulvey, will certainly keep we'll look deep into that, and I'm certain that Oregon Department of Forestry would come and say if we need any legislative action. I don't know if we do or not at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm assuming you're talking sewage-based pollution, since I was hearing septic tanks being referenced. Yep. If it is sewage-based, could it be possibly city municipalities that are dumping their sewage into the river directly?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Hurd, this is when I mentioned sewage, the Coastal Zone Program really looks at what do we do to protect coast watersheds, and that's that program, if you will, is given to the state by the federal agencies, and so they conditionally approved our program many years ago, and one was for the forest practices, one was for new development on the coast, how new development happened. The on-site system they're referring to as individual on-site septic systems, and making sure that we, the state of Oregon, had a program that was good enough to ensure that that end of it was being looked at. As Representative Holvey would know, and others might know, as the last session, we did get what we call a sort of a time of transfer disclosure requirement, where if I have a selling my home to you, and I have a septic system, I disclose that, hey, I have a septic system, and this is what it looks like, and it hasn't been inspected for this long. So then the burden, I guess, shifts to you of whether, in terms of buying that house, whether or not you would like to have it inspected or have it, you know, fixed or whatever the case may be. But it's referring not to municipal discharges, but to individual on-site systems.
Follow up. So in regards to testing those systems at the point of transfer between, say, from you to me, mm-hmm. Is that not already part of the inspection process when the bank is assuming it's going to have a loan mm-hmm. applied to it by the new purchaser?
Representative Vega Peterson, Representative Hurd, it is not. It's not a requirement. It becomes an option. Whether or not a bank would say, hey, do it or not, I don't know.
One last follow-up. Is it possible that some of this pollution from these septic tanks is from the fact that most people do not pump them regularly as they should, or is it because they're failing?
Yeah. Representative Vega Peterson, Representative Hurd, there's a lot of reason. Both of those, I think maintenance is an issue, and just not replacing a system. There is a legislative concept that's coming about. How do we create a fund, if you will, that can be available to people that are low income to fix their systems? These systems aren't easy to fix, so that's a concept that we have. It's set up a program for that, and so that's one of the biggest challenges. These are not particularly easy systems to fix.
Thank you.
Finance-wise.
Representative Reardon.
Well, these have been great presentations, very helpful. So you get one softball. Could you refresh my memory on your respective roles and when we start talking about the EPA's 111 B and D?
Okay.
And when
mm-hmm.
they're coming down and
yes.
you know, what each of you do?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Reardon.
And I'll just add a comment. We will have a informational on the 111D as well, too. So.
I
can do it. I think 111D is a proposal by the Environmental Protection Agency to control CO2 emission from carbon from coal-fired plants. And so what that means for Oregon is every state, including Oregon, is expected to reduce their CO2 that's related to to coal-fired plants. Oregon gets 60%. 60% of its electricity comes from coal-fired plants. Boardman's going to be shutting down, but we still get power from Montana, Wyoming, and Utah, I believe, are the three states. So it's still the proposal by EPA is, what is Oregon going to do relative to electricity coming in from those plants? And where we have to look is energy efficiency and renewable energy, because we don't have a coal-fired plant other than Boardman that we can do work on. So, but we work very closely with Director Kaplan and his agency, as well as PUC, who's, I think, up next. But we'll be talking to the committee about that for sure.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, appreciate it. Mr. Kaplan, I just had a follow-up for you off of your list of ODO priorities. You, again, talk about rewriting the mission statement. I would hope that somewhere in that statement is the acknowledgement that the department really does exist to try to ensure the affordability and plentiful access to energy for all Oregonians and Oregon businesses so that our quality of life and our economic vitality can be maintained and we can continue to grow.
Chair Vega Peterson, Vice Chair Johnson, I think that's very much in line with where our staff is in terms of what they feel their responsibility is. Encapsulating the breadth of our agency in a short is a little difficult, but it's certainly along the vein of what we're thinking as well. So that's advice that's falling on receptive ears.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we look forward to seeing that. I just had one question, and this was more a question of agencies working together, not so much on where there might be redundancy, but where there be overlap in your missions. I was just talking to Mayor Bemis from Gresham, and they have a wastewater treatment plant that they've actually is now creating their own energy. So it went from being one of the major, most expensive parts of the city government to actually now generating money, from the energy that's produced. So can you talk a little, I don't know if it exists, but the overlap between the two agencies mm-hmm. and the work that you do. Mm-hmm.
I'll start. Chair Vega Peterson, related to the House bill that's coming up following this, is that we really look to work with wastewater treatment facilities to be really energy efficient or really even generate their own energy, which some do. A Gresham facility is an example of that. So we could loan out money that would help and to put in energy efficient features and as part of their construction upgrade. And certainly we work with the Oregon Department of Energy on a number of fronts in terms of if there are dollars available through ODO, we will work together to make sure that we're not approaching that from different ways, but approaching it together.
Chair Vega Peterson, I'd echo that. I'd also say that a lot of energy projects overlap with a number of state agencies. There's mm-hmm. interaction with Department of Agriculture, for example, on biomass, Department of Forestry for woody biomass. We try and find as much as possible mutually beneficial policy bents as we're advancing issues throughout the state. So I echo the director's comments and say that we're actively looking for those collaborations and finding benefits at cross purpose. So we're not cross-purpose.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My father owns a company called Hurd Farms, which is a sewage treatment plant in Southern Oregon, and it's covered, and so it captures the methane, and currently he's just simply burning it off to prevent odor. But even though I'm not affiliated with his company, him and I have always been trying to figure out how can we purify the methane and convert it into actual compressed gas that you can use it through fleet trucks and whatnot. Do either of you have any suggestions on how other similar companies or facilities can actually start producing that kind of a product that's actually affordable?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Hurd. I'm sure there are people who work at the Department of Energy who could. I cannot, but we can certainly get in touch with you and let you know about that.
Representative Reardon.
The plant at Gresham is doing exactly that. Mm-hmm. How affordable is, I can't say for sure, but they are doing that. It's really worth a visit.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Okay. Thank you both so much for coming down. We look forward to seeing you more in the session, I'm sure.
Yep.
So for the next panel, I'm going to invite Sue Ackerman and Jason Eisendorfer. Sue's the chair of the the Public Utility Commission. Jason, the Utility Program Director. Thank you so much for coming today.
You are most welcome. I'm sorry, I'm going to put myself on a timer because we don't want to get too far off time here. But Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, thank you for having us here. Like our colleagues at DEQ and Department of Energy, we're happy to talk about our agency. We're always happy to talk about our agency. And so feel free to interrupt me if you have questions as we go. Some of these things, some of the slides, because it's actually kind of a thick deck, we might just blow through and trust that you'll have a chance to come back later on and read through them. We're always available to answer questions, so let's go on to the first slide. We are a three-person commission appointed by the governor for four-year staggered terms. We are also obviously confirmed by the Oregon Senate. So, this is our mission statement. And I think you've seen this before because I believe you have all been drinking from the fire hose recently about energy. But our mission is an economic mission, which is to ensure safe and reliable utility services are provided to consumers at just and reasonable rates through regulation where we need to and the introduction of competitive forces where we can. We receive no general or lottery funds. We are a fee-based agency as well. Consumers pay about 17 cents per month for our services right now on their bill. So, go ahead. This is the scope of what we do. We regulate the investor-owned utilities only. These are for-profit utilities, not the consumer-owned utilities that are regulated by their boards or their cities, depending on what type of entity they are. So we regulate three private investor-owned electric utilities. They are Portland General Electric, Pacific Core, and Idaho Power. They have about 1.4 million customers between among the three of them. We regulate three private natural gas utilities. Northwest Natural is the largest, and then there's Avista and Cascade Natural Gas, about 775,000 consumers among the three of them. We regulate about 373 telecommunications companies. We also regulate about 80 small water companies, small water utilities. Those are very small. These are people who purchase property and discover that they became a water company because they need to serve the people that are living next door. Very interesting. So I know you are an energy committee. You're going to hear a little bit from us about the non-energy things we do because it's part of our scope. Go ahead. So this is the scope of what we do. The revenue that our investor-owned utilities collect is just under $5 billion a year, and so we feel somewhat responsible that those dollars are being spent wisely. Our investor-owned utilities are about two-thirds of the electricity actually sold in the state and about close to 75% of the number of electric customers in the state. The rest, of course, are served by public power utilities that we don't regulate. Investor-owned utility natural gas utilities account for 100% of the sales and service to customers in Oregon for natural gas. We don't have any publicly owned natural gas utilities here. The investor-owned utilities have the right to ask for rate adjustments when they feel like it, when they think they need it. I don't think they ever do it just for fun, because those processes are not fun. But the frequency of them has really increased, particularly with the electricity committee, the electricity utilities more recently, to about once per year we get a case filed. So our statutory responsibility is to represent customers of a public utility or telecommunications utility and the public generally in all controversies respecting rates, valuations, service, and all matters of which we have jurisdiction. That's in our statute. We also have in our statute the obligation to balance interests between ratepayers and utilities. And we also try to manage the effects of federal and state regulation and a policy that affect the utilities and their systems. So we're going to go through these pretty fast. Got a number of responsibilities. We set utility rates for homes and businesses. The legal terminology is ensure that rates are just and reasonable. So we set and enforce price and service rules to protect consumers. That's our job. We ensure that private energy utility companies meet their customer needs at the combined lowest and least cost that they can. And what we mean by that, I think you heard from Jason a couple days ago, but you can always get the lowest cost resource. It might not in the long term be the best resource because things happen. In the case of coal, obviously, that's one of the cheapest resources right now. But we know that there is risk of environmental regulation in the future that could make it very pricey. So that's one of the risks we look at. It's an economic risk. That is also true for natural gas generation. Natural gas prices more recently have been fairly stable, but they are notoriously volatile. And so we take that into account when we're having the utilities plan to meet consumers' needs at the lowest combination of risk and cost. We also approve a number of utility transactions, such things as mergers and property sales and all sorts of contracts that we do. We set and enforce service quality standards to make sure consumers are getting good service. We resolve customer complaints about their utilities, and that's actually a big piece of what we do. We've got some really competent, good staff that will take calls from consumers about their utilities, and we often are with managing between the consumer and the utility and making sure the issues get worked out. This is some of our non-energy responsibility. We manage a $33 million per year program to ensure that there are affordable phones in high-cost areas in the state. We set and enforce rules for fair competition both in energy and in telecommunications. We also have a safety division, another one of my favorite divisions within within our agency is our safety staff. And they've got a pretty important job, and that's to make sure that natural gas pipelines, power lines, transformer stations, and all energy facilities are actually operating safely. So moving on, again, we advocate for Oregon in regional and federal forums, too, where we occasionally make appearances, sometimes more than others, is the Federal Communications Commission over telecommunications and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for energy, interstate energy matters. And more recently, the EPA. We have had our share of, as Director Peterson indicated, we've had our share of conversations with the Environmental Protection Agency over the last year regarding the 111D rules. The Energy Trust is a big chunk of our responsibility. We work to make sure that they are acquiring energy efficiency on behalf of Pacific Core, PGE, Northwest Natural, and Cascade Natural Gas, and that they are doing it in the most efficient and effective way they can. So they use a lot of competitive processes in order to deliver services, and we monitor that. We also have oversight of regulated providers concerning seismic and cybersecurity preparedness. We spend time with our utilities making sure that they are thinking about it and organizing themselves and doing what they can to be prepared both for seismic risk and then for increasingly cybersecurity risks. So the next is our organization, and what you can see here are the three commissioners on top. To my right, Jason Eisdorfer is what I fondly like to call the fourth commissioner because he's so important to us. But you'll see on this organization that we have three large branches that we have organized ourselves into, and I'll go into that in more detail later. But the first one is the utility program. Jason is the head of the utility program. We have 75 full-time employees in this division. They handle energy, including energy resources and planning. They handle energy rates, finance, and audits. We have a telecom and water division, which handles telecommunications and water matters, including competitive issues in the telecommunications industry and universal service issues is big in telecom. We also have utility safety, reliability, and security. Those are some of my favorite staff members, actually. All of our staff people are favorites to me, but this is a very impressive group of people. And then our consumer services group, these are the folks that address complaints that consumers might have against their utilities. And finally, regulatory policy, which we deal with a lot. You can think of the utility program as what we call the technical and analytical arm of the Public Utility Commission. These folks are highly skilled, highly educated economists, engineers, finance people, accountants, CPAs, lawyers, very dedicated to the mission of the PUC, and they've got very difficult jobs. And so below in this last bullet are some of the matters that they look into, and I'm not going to read them to you. I'll just let them be up there. Move on to the next slide in the utility program. The utility program does a lot of cooperating with various parties in our dockets, our cases, like the utilities themselves, the consumer interests like CUB and the industrial consumers representatives, as well as environmental groups. So we get a lot of public participation in our dockets, and it requires our staff to not just think on behalf of the public interest, but engage with these other representatives that are out there and in the cases. The utility program will recommend rates that will give IOUs, this is kind of the legal standard, an opportunity to recover prudent costs and an opportunity to earn a reasonable return on the capital they've invested in utility service. So this part of it, this part of the program is a very analytical part of the program, and it ensures that utilities are developing a mix of new resources that meet customer needs over time at a combination of the lowest cost and risk. We've already talked about that. We ensure compliance with renewable portfolio standard, including the cost cap that is in that statute. We encourage installation of renewable energy resources owned by consumers, including net metering and solar pilot programs. We ensure market competition in electricity and local communications markets. We administer natural gas safety, pipeline safety programs that are actually adopted by the federal government, the Pipeline Hazards, Materials, and Safety Administration. In fact, we get money from what we call FMSA. Fondly, of course, we call them FMSA, to help pay for the staff that administer these safety programs. That safety program also inspects lines and facilities of the electric companies, including consumer-owned utilities. That is the one exception to the rule that we don't regulate consumer-owned utilities, as we do have safety responsibility for the consumer-owned utilities. We provide support to the Office of Emergency Management during disasters and emergencies, and with our utilities, we have promoted disaster mutual aid cooperation, which means the utilities will enter into agreements with other utilities around the country for support if the big 9.0 quake comes or some other emergency. They would have the ability to access the resources of other utilities in other states rather than maintaining all of it on their own dime. We also monitor utility compliance with energy security regulations like cybersecurity. Moving on, the Energy Trust. We oversee the Energy Trust of Oregon. As I said before, it's to ensure that it produces really good results in terms of the conservation savings that they achieve and the renewable resource development that they engage in, and that they do so efficiently. And we have a lot of mechanisms that we use to conduct that oversight, and they're listed below. I'm not going to read them to you. But we take that very seriously.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to bore in a little bit more on that relationship between the PUC and ETO. Maybe you'll recall there was a newspaper article sometime in the last year from the Oregonian talking about one of the concerns about ETO is that some of the resources seem to be delving into the area of comfort and within the residential environment instead of being primarily focused on efficiencies and so forth. As we go further, it only seems natural that maybe we've achieved got the most bang for the buck we can on the residential side, so therefore some of their measures are targeted more towards indoor air quality, comfort, that kind of thing. But just talk to me or share a little bit about how that relationship with the ETO goes and how you try to direct their programs, again, so it meets these criteria that you've laid out here.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, thank you for that question. You've actually put your finger on a very hot topic right now in all of the utility industry, which is what's fair for consumers to pay for and what's not. The biggest way we interact with the Energy Trust is actually through the utilities themselves, because we require, I think Jason talked to you about this a few days ago, something called integrated resource planning, and that's where the utilities decide how they're going to serve the needs of the consumers at the lowest cost and risk over a long period of time. And, of course, the most effective resource is actually not using the resource, it's energy efficiency. And so the Energy Trust's responsibility is to acquire all of the cost-effective energy efficiency that the utilities identify in their integrated resource plans. So that's step number one, is for us to identify how much energy efficiency is cost-effective. There is quite frankly, a raging debate going on in the energy efficiency and utility world right now about how much other than economic costs should you consider. And I think the comfort issue is one of those. But there are other things like environmental costs. You know, do you include in your cost avoidance the concept of avoided emissions and that sort of thing? Well, we do a little bit of that at the PUC. But we are mostly interested, we are economic regulators, we are mostly interested in making sure that they are acquiring as much energy efficiency as they can at the lowest cost. That's our predominant interest. We do have a, and I'm going to let Jason step in here, he might want to add a few things, but we do have an order that goes back about a decade or maybe longer that talks about when we'll make exceptions to those cost effectiveness rules. Mm-hmm. And we did that recently with some natural gas efficiency programs because the cost of gas being very low, a lot of those energy efficiency programs can't get to that at least one cost-effective ratio anymore. So we have used those that order and that policy to decide when we might vary from a strict cost-effectiveness test. But we don't actually consider comfort. I think I'm going directly here. It's not something that we consider. I think the Energy Trust might very well think about what is the best way to deliver a program, and they can decide that there's an awful lot of really good energy efficiency here to be delivered to this home or to this business, and it may coincidentally make these businesses more comfortable, but it's not one of the things that we consider. And Jason, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Bence.
Thank you. So this is really an interesting. I want to go back to your remark a moment about the fact that as natural gas drops, the measure of efficiency and the definition becomes much more challenging. But here's what I'm interested in. There's been a great deal of discussion about the rationale underlying the need for efficiency. And I think in the past it might have been we didn't have enough power. So to the extent we could save, we wouldn't have to build another power plant. But now I would suggest that there seems to be quite a bit of pressure to reduce use of energy because of emissions. And this would mean that efficiency in some part is being driven by the need to have a cleaner environment. Am I on the track so far?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Bence. Sorry, it just went off on me. Sorry, Representative Bence.
Because I haven't gotten to my point yet, so
okay,
I'll just get
ahead.
To it.
You're still tracking. It's still coming.
The question is, if the rationale underlying the energy trust is efficiency, and if efficiency is cleaner air and less carbon, then why aren't you folks pressuring them to utilize much more of what they have to reach that result? Now, you notice there's three ifs in that question. So go back and correct them if you would, and then you can tell me how we can arrange things so that perhaps we redirect their mission.
Redirect the ETO's mission, sir?
Yes. And give us and share with us, there's been a lot of long-term planning placed into what the ETO does and how it spends its money. But it's been my observation that there's a lot of make work going on, and the struggle to find efficient projects continues every day. We got a good vision of this as we looked at the comparison between the Betsy and what the ETO was doing, and we saw a lot of overlap. We don't have the Betsy anymore. So my question is broad. You can pick any part of it you'd like to answer.
Well, again, we are an economic regulator, not an environmental regulator. We care about emissions, number one, because we're Oregonians, but also because the prospect of future regulation of emissions means that there's a prospect of a cost, a risk of costs, and we do take that into account all the time. And so predominantly what the Energy Trust is trying to do, or representative, is to find energy efficiency to minimize costs. That's what we're all about. And
if I may, so I asked a year ago, I think, or two in this very room, if the cost of natural gas falls to zero, cost seems to be irrelevant, right? because the only cost you're then worried about is the environment cost. So now keep in mind, my hypothetical is natural gas falls to zero. Now, there may be long-term built-in costs that you still haven't paid yet, but I need to have you explain the efficiency to me if energy costs nothing.
That's an excellent question. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Bence.
I bet you do.
There are things other than just the energy costs, obviously. I mean, when we set rates for the utilities, it covers all the costs that the utility has invested in, which is the capital cost and the and the variable cost. We're talking about a variable energy cost of natural gas. And we would still look at it from a cost effectiveness standpoint. What's the most, the cheapest way to meet the needs of consumers? If gas prices fall to zero, that would be a very difficult situation for us.
Yeah. If I may, Ms. Manager. The hypothetical is just to drive the thought forward of what is it, what's the value of that which the Energy Trust is doing? Because if conservation isn't unnecessary, if you can't justify conservation by virtue of cost, which I just heard you say kind of because you compare the cost of buying natural gas to the cost of conservation, which right now I will just about challenge anybody to say that conservation costs less than natural gas, because it doesn't. And so the point is, why are we doing it? Shouldn't we be redirecting the what the ETO is doing so that we're actually getting value for that which we're putting into it? Mm-hmm. Now, that's why I'm asking you as the PUC if you're asking these kinds of questions of them.
I'm going to let Jason answer this. A very good question, Representative.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Bentz, energy efficiency does cost less than running natural gas through a turbine, even delivering it directly to the customer. So,
wait, Madam Chair. So I researched this 3 years ago, and as I was reviewing the governor's 10-year energy plan. So I need to have you share with me what you think the cost per kilowatt hour of conservation is across the nation. Then you can share with me what it is here in Oregon, because I actually did look that up. Now, perhaps it's changed in over the 3 years. What does it cost per kilowatt hour for conservation?
Representative Vega Peterson, Representative Vance, in Oregon, it's about 3 cents per kilowatt hour is what conservation, electric conservation costs. Across the country, it can be much higher because we actually do it. I'm going to sound like a Oregonian here, but we actually do it better than a lot of regions in the country do. And the reason we like energy efficiency in Oregon at 3 cents per kilowatt hour is because that is cheaper than any other supply side resource that is out there.
Madam Chair, one last question and I'm done. I need to see those figures because the 3.5 cents is variable. It depends on the project, so you need to share with me not just what you're quoting at 3.5 cents. I need to see the others, because it's higher than that, at least on the research I did. Now, I'm not on the commission, and so you guys have the facts. I don't, and you have great folks working there. And so I appreciate the hard work the commission does. So I would sure like to see those numbers, not just the 3 cent ones, all of them. And it would be great to see the ETOs also.
Of course, we are talking about numbers on an average basis.
Yes, we are.
Right? There are some energy efficiency measures come in. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Ben, many of these projects come in well below 3.5 cents, and some come in above, but on average they're getting it, the Energy Trust is, I think, is getting it now at 3.5 cents. And I'm familiar with Massachusetts, for example, and I saw recently, and I can get this information for you, I think it's somewhere upwards of 11 or 12 cents per kWh that they're spending to get energy efficiency. Of course, they're a higher cost region than we are, and so their cost effectiveness thresholds are probably different from ours. But I will get that information for you.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead and continue. We do have, I'm just going to go ahead, because we have a public hearing, a bill that we need to hear too.
Let's just real quick, if I may, I would like to see the information broken down per each item as well. I mean, if you're going to get it for Representative Bentz, it'd probably be good for everybody on the committee to have that.
And we'll ask you to share it for the committee. Okay, that would be great.
Right. Chair Vicki Peterson, Representative Widener, happy to do that. Thank you. Okay, let's go to the next one. Yeah, let's skip this one. This is about telecom. We're just going to go straight to the utility program. This bar chart, which shows you how the effect that our staff has and the commission has when we are establishing rates for consumers. Utilities can ask for whatever they want, and then our professional staff and the parties go into these proceedings, and they roll up their sleeves, and they scrub them very hard. And what you see here are the differences between what utilities have asked for and what we ended up approving for them. And so I'll leave that there and let you go. This is the third large branch of the Public Utility Commission, our Administrative Hearings Division. Something I probably should have said earlier, but you know, the PUC actually does a lot of delegated legislative work. We are, rate making is what's considered a legislative function, but we also have kind of a quasi-judicial function, and that is when utilities come in for cases or someone's property interests or freedom interests are involved. I don't think we have those issues at the PUC, but we do something that's very close to trial-like procedures, and we need administrative law judges that conduct those trials for us, and that's what the Administrative Hearings Division does. They're independent from us because we're trying to keep them fair for the parties. In the sense that they operate like judges do in these quasi-judicial proceedings. We have our own administrative law judges. We are one of the agencies in the state that is exempt from required use of the ALJs in the Office of Administrative Hearings, and we do that because we need ALJs with real expertise in energy and telecommunications and water. So that's our third big that's our second big branch. The next is policy administration. That is the third big branch of our commission. Policy administration includes the commissioners, the commission office. We have assistants that help us out. Thank the Lord. Human resources, including training and reception. We've got a business services group and information technology. There's also something called the Residential Service Protection Fund with 8 employees, and we are the administrative oversight of the Board of Maritime Pilots, and that's within policy administration. We don't actually regulate the maritime pilots. They were given to us for administrative purposes. They're so small, they needed someone to just do their work for them, and so we do that. The Residential Service Protection Fund is another telecom matter. It supports the state's policy that all Oregonians have access to adequate and affordable telephone service. So there are 4 programs here managed by 8 employees within our division. It's based on a surcharge on access lines, and it has decreased over the years from 12 cents per bill down to 9 cents per bill more recently. So this is a very high-level view of our budget. We are about $111 million per biennium for us, but a lot of that is just pass-through. The pass-through is on the right. That's the Oregon Universal Service Fund predominantly. That is the fund that we collect money per access line from telecommunications providers in order to help offset costs of telecommunications in high-cost areas. The one on the left is actually more specific to our operations, in my opinion. This is a biennium. So you can see our utility program has the most employees and the biggest budget. Policy administration is next, and then there's the Residential Service and Protection Fund. But that is, again, that's pretty much managing costs and sending out programs to consumers. So these next 2 slides I'm going to go through very quickly. Again, the point I want to make with these slides, this is our budget over the last few cycles. We are very much a kind of a steady state agency. We don't go up or down very often. We kind of steady, I guess. Thank you. We have a number of, we have a couple of bills that will come in front of you probably at some point during this legislative session. One is Senate Bill 286. This regards civil penalties that we have the option of assessing against natural gas utilities if they are in violation of the federal natural gas safety rules. We get money from the federal government, like our colleagues at DEQ do, to manage the federal pipeline safety programs. So we get money from the federal government to help fund staff that does this work. They have always wanted our penalties to exactly match the federal penalties, and so that's what this statute does. This bill would do is it would have our state penalties match the federal penalties. But I think I mentioned this to a few of you in past meetings. We don't actually make it a point of fining or penalizing our utilities. We'd rather see the utilities actually get it right and spend their money being safe. And for the most part, we think we have that in Oregon. Senate Bill 329 is another bill that we are supporting. It is to increase our Utility gross operating revenue fee, as I indicated earlier, we are not general fund funded. We are funded with fees. For the last 25 years, it's been like 17 cents per consumer bill per month. And a couple things are happening out there. One is that in telecommunications, people are giving up their landlines and going to cell phones. That charge is not on wireless bills, and so the revenue from the landlines is going down. That's also true for energy because of energy efficiency. The amount of energy that people are using is going down, and so revenues are lost there. So our revenue growth right now is not meeting our expectations. We're asking for our fee, which is 0.25% of every utility's gross operating revenue to 30%. And that'll increase the per month charge for our services from 17 cents to 20 cents. So it's a 3-cent increase. There is an awful lot of other legislation we're aware of that's out there, and I'm sure you're aware of this,
Madam
too. This is not...
Excuse me, Representative Benz.
Thank you. So what does that add up to, the 3-cent increase?
20 cents per month per bill?
No. What's the total amount raised?
Total amount raised is going to be about... I'm going to have to go back to my... It's about $44 million.
Is it 3% or the total budget?
That's the total budget.
So three, but I'm trying to get at what the 3%, what the 3 cents is.
The difference is.
Oh, I'd have to get that for you. I don't know.
That'd be good. Thank you.
Thank you. So this and the next one are just some of the other pieces of legislation that we are aware are circulating out there that involve us, but they were not introduced by us. That's why I'm sure we are going to be seeing each other frequently over the next few months. I'm not going to read them to you. I'll just.
I'm sure we'll hear these as they come through.
You, Chair Vega Peterson, committee, we really appreciate your time. And as always, you can always call if you need information for us. We've got a couple of questions we need to answer here, and we'll do that quickly.
Thank you so much for your time. We do have a bill that we need to hear, so I just wanted to check to see if there are any short, small questions. Nope. Okay, thank you so much
for
coming. We look forward to seeing you more this session. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2451, State Water Pollution Control Revolving Fund. I'd like to call up Director Dick Peterson from DEQ and Tracy Rutten from the League of Oregon Cities. Hello again.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, hello again. Dick Peterson, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here today to seek your support for House Bill 2451 in the -1 amendment. House Bill 2451 pertains to DEQ's Water Pollution Control Revolving Fund Program. These days it's more commonly known as the Clean Water State Revolving Fund Program. Before I get into the bill and amendment, I would like just a very short background on the program. The program provides low-cost financing for the planning, design, and construction of projects that address water pollution issues. These projects include wastewater treatment facilities and upgrades, sewer replacement rehabilitation, stormwater controls, irrigation, and certain types of pollution runoff. New facilities and facility upgrades allow communities to meet the demands of growing populations and new or expanded businesses and allow communities to replace aging infrastructure. DEQ has issued over $1 billion in loans to more than 150 communities since the program began in 1990. Financing is available to public agencies, including tribal governments, cities, counties, sanitary districts, soil and water conservation districts, irrigation districts, various special districts, and other government entities. There's two categories of project finance through the program: treatment works and non-treatment works. Treatment works include wastewater treatment plants and associated infrastructure. Non-treatment works include things such as upgrades to irrigation systems and stormwater controls.
Director Peterson, I'm just going
right to
interrupt you 1 sec because there's a little bit of confusion.
Yeah.
So, colleagues, you can find the bill itself on OLIS, and then what you'll find in front of you is the -1 amendment, which is in addition to the bill. The other LC draft that you see was just the committee bill that we entered in at the beginning of the session.
Dylan, I was a confused.
I will. It's my vice chair confusion, but please go ahead and proceed.
Continue.
Thank you.
Okay, you bet. So existing Oregon law allows DQ to offer loans for terms up to 20 years or the useful life of the asset, whichever is shorter, for both treatment works and non-treatment works. Also, existing law allows DQ to enter into bond purchase agreements that effectively spread the repayment term over 30 years rather than 20 years. However, statutory language limits this financing option, the bond purchase agreement, just to treatment work projects. So House Bill 2451 would allow up to 30-year bond purchase agreements for all eligible projects, including non-treatment works. The Dash 1 amendment is offered that would allow 30-year loan term for all projects as well. So for both bond purchase and loans, the Dash 1 provides it for loans. So therefore, if this bill is amended and passed, DEQ would be able to offer a 30-year loan term and 30-year bond purchase agreement to public agencies seeking finance through the Clean Water State Revolving Fund program for all eligible projects, making projects more affordable for Oregon communities. Our Stakeholder Advisory Committee strongly supports both the bill and amendment, and I hope you will support the bill and the Dash 1 amendment as well. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm curious, where do the funds come from for the Oregon Clean Water State Revolving Fund?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holvey, we get a capital grant from the Environmental Protection Agency, and then we sell bonds for that, and then we loan that money out, and then the loan proceeds come back to DEQ to continue to build that fund or keep that fund going.
So
follow up.
So what's the balance in that fund right now? Do we? How much money is available to loan out?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holvey, I'm not exactly sure. I have someone in staff with me that could answer that question if you'd like me to bring her up. I'm happy to do so.
Well, I can get it later, too.
Okay, well, we can provide that to you later.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Representative Reardon.
So is this the type of money that was used on the Gresham waste treatment plants? Is that where that would be?
Chair Vega Peterson, Vice Chair Reardon, yes, it was. Yep.
We should do more of that.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the difference now is we're offering 30-year term rather than 20-year term, which is a benefit to communities.
Could be helpful.
Yep.
Okay, thank you so much. Go ahead.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Rutten with the League of Oregon Cities. I'm here today on behalf of our 242 cities across the state, many of which provide wastewater services to their citizens. And I do have to thank Vice Chair Reardon for coming out to the Gresham Wastewater Treatment Tour. I would extend that invitation to any of you. It's pretty incredible to see some of the innovative solutions they have come up with in that community. And really, we're seeing it across the state with a lot of the wastewater treatment folks that we work with, really doing some incredible projects in both energy efficiency and water quality. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2451 and the Dash 1 amendments. Any opportunity that we have to provide for more flexible financing opportunities, obviously potential to save our communities significant amount of money in addressing their ever-increasing infrastructure needs. We are seeing significant challenges across the state, and especially in a lot of our small and rural communities, in addressing those needs. In 2010, the American Society of Civil Engineers released their 2010 report card for Oregon. And in that report card, they identified $3.8 billion in wastewater infrastructure needs over the next 20 years. And that's for our wastewater systems alone. So the need is significant. We believe that this bill will help us to be able to better address some of those needs. And also has the added benefit of supporting some of the green infrastructure projects that we're seeing that are more common in our communities. Those include things like low impact development, natural treatment solutions to help cool water before it's discharged. So a variety, again, of very innovative projects to address very complex challenges. I thank you, and happy to answer any questions.
No. Okay, thank you so much. And we have one more person who signed up to testify, and it's Mark, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name, Lalor, from the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Oregon.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Mark Landauer. I represent the Special Districts Association of Oregon, our district. We have 950 districts across the state of Oregon, providing approximately 30 types of services to the citizens of Oregon. Needless to say, one of those happens to be treatment works. This is a bill that we certainly support. We support the Dash 1 amendment, and both the director and Ms. Rutten explained to you why. I'd just like to hit home one last thing. Ultimately, spreading out the terms of these loans will reduce the cost to the ratepayers, and I just want to make sure that you understand that many of the communities that have received these bills, it can be a struggle to afford the bills. They are going up, and this will help taper those bills over time, and I hope that you'll find your way to support and move this measure quickly. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you so much for your time. All right. All right, with that, I'm going to go ahead and, unless there's anything anyone wanted to add, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2451. Committee, the one I would like to draw your attention to on OLIS is meeting material that's 2015 Potential House Energy and Environment Issues List. It's something that Beth was kind enough to put together just to summarize what we're seeing in terms of the bills that have been sent to our committee, assigned to our committee, as well as some of the different topics that we're going to be talking about. This is something that I went through with a similar category list with the vice chairs. You can go ahead and open it up and take a look at that. We don't have to go through it line by line right now, but it does go through some of the major categories that we're looking at in terms of topics for discussion this session, including air quality, climate and the economy, energy, water quality, and materials management. As you look through this document, if you have bills that you know are going to be coming this way or are going to be submitted that haven't got there yet, that you want to give us a heads up on, we're always happy to hear that. But this will just, I thought this would be helpful in giving you a sense of the direction and some of the things that we're going to cover this session.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes.
Can you direct us a little bit further toward where that is?
Okay, sure.
While we're sitting here.
So in OLIS, if you go into the agenda, the committee information for today's committee, and you go into the meeting materials.
Gotcha.
It should be one of the first ones listed there.
Thank you.
Okay. So that is for your weekend reading enjoyment. All right. Representative Holby.
Oh, Madam Chair, I just wanted to thank you and the committee administrator. Also, just to highlight, there is a, you know, you can go in and look at the committee and see all of the assigned majors with a link to the bills that are assigned to the committee as well. So that's really helpful, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. All right. Okay, with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the committee. Everybody have a great weekend.